And our sermon text this day is Acts 22, verse 30 to 23:35, beginning on page 932 in your Pew Bible. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day." And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law? And yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck." Those who stood by said, "Would you revile God's high priest?" And Paul said, "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" Now when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees, the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, "Brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial." And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply, "We find nothing wrong with this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him?" And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, "Take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath, neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we are ready to kill him before he comes near." Now, the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. So he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him." So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, "Paul, the prisoner, called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you." The tribune took him by the hand and, going aside, asked him privately, "What is it that you have to tell me?" And he said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him. But do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him. We have bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent." So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, "Tell no one that you have informed me of these things." Then he called two of the centurions and said, "Get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And he wrote a letter to this effect: "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon him with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him." So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris. And on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. And they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor. They presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive." and he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium. What does it feel like to have a conspiracy made against you? American people? Almost everyone has had someone, perhaps, or some group move against him or her, whether in large or small ways. I thought of, once again, of Joseph Stalin. Having read his biography here recently, he insisted that every Dachau and bedroom and office that he used have a secret escape route. You find all tyrants have this same kind of, Hitler had the same thing, Mao had the same thing, paranoid about being who they were. Stalin was taken by surprise by a plot that was more or less out in the open, Operation Barbarossa. On June 22, 1941, some 4 million German soldiers poured over the western border of the Soviet Union in the largest land invasion in the history of warfare. Adolf Hitler had been plotting his conquering of Russia for years, and his troops would drive to the gates of Moscow, the gates of Leningrad, and most ominously, the gates of Stalingrad. If you haven't seen the movie yet, Enemy at the Gates, just an excellent recounting of those dark days. Now, it's hard to hide 4 million troops and their equipment. Stalin had reliable intelligence of Hitler's preparations. Even Mao tried to raise the alarm, but Stalin knew better. He was convinced that Hitler would not actually invade, but that he would honor the German-Soviet pact, the Molotov-Ribbentrop pact, it's also known as, signed in 1939. He thought he would honor it at least until he had defeated the British. He was certain that they would not invade at least until, and Stalin had plans to invade Germany too. Few people know that, but he had plans to invade Germany too as soon as England had been invaded. But when the invasion actually took place, Stalin was crushed. He went into a deep depression. He retired to his quarters. He wasn't seen in public for months. His inner circle felt that he might commit suicide, even as his wife had done some years earlier. It was the worst crisis of confidence in Stalin's career. Poor Joe. Poor Joseph Stalin, huh? What do you think went through his mind? How could I have been so stupid? That dirty rat Hitler betraying me? What will become of me? What do others think of me? Who's still doing stuff like this? It only increased his paranoia. Have you ever experienced this personally? Maybe on a smaller scale, though. I remember distinctly having an owner of the fleur-de-lis restaurant reveal to me in my exit interview that my sous chef had been plotting behind my back to get my job. She had attempted to turn not only his mind against me, but that of the entire kitchen. Yet on the surface, everything was smiles, goodwill. Now, I'm sure many of you have had similar experiences. If you work in an office environment with a number of people, these kinds of things are bound to transpire, aren't they? I can see the wheels turning already in many of your minds. Yet it might also be asked, how has God used these machinations of others to accomplish his will in your life? He did in mine. That sous chef never got me fired. I left because of a move, and I just went on to bigger and better things that I saw coming right from the will of God, too. And a case could be made that God used the Hitler-Stalin dispute to wear each other down such that the Allies suffered many, many fewer casualties as each German, Nazi, and Russian communist killed the other. Equally, a case can be made that the conspiracy hatched against the Apostle Paul here furthered the gospel, propelling that gospel to the very capital of the empire that is Rome, right? That is what is underway. Let's examine our text today and see, indeed, how God's providence, that's another major theme of this text, isn't it? God's providence through machinations. That's our title today, machinations. First of all, on the inside flap of your bulletin, you'll find an outline if you want to track with us. 3 points I want to make. under machinations. The design of Paul's enemies, the Sanhedrin, will propel him in God's providence towards Rome. Chapter 22:30-23:11. God's ways may seem circuitous to us, but they eventually achieve their objective, do they not? God's glory and our good, the good of the church. God's providence in men, evil men's machinations. I can only imagine how Paul felt personally, emotionally, how dark and despairing he must have been much of this time. While many men cower in fear over clandestine conspiracies against them, Paul more or less knew it, who it was who hated him. That is, his own Jewish brothers in the Sanhedrin. I'm a Pharisee, a Pharisee of Pharisees. Machination. A plan set in motion to trap or kill. Plot. Conspiracy. Machination. You can see the word machine in there, can't you? The idea of a design or a machine, if you will, set up to kill, trap, destroy. While not privy to all the details, our unnamed tribune decides to hold an old-fashioned Roman trial to ascertain the facts of the case here. If we're going to understand the facts of this case, it is important to note this distinction, however. What we have before us in chapter 23 is a Roman inquiry, not a session meeting of the Jewish Sanhedrin. Once again, our scholar, I respect very much, Ramsey, who was that Oxford Don, who went abroad into the regions that Paul had explored in order to disprove Christianity by disproving its factuality, and instead became converted, didn't he? He has some profound insights here. Three things I want to note with you. First of all, it was at his initiative, that is the tribune, Claudius is his name, as we have seen, it was at his initiative that the trial was called. It was the tribune who desired to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, the text says. So the Roman impulse towards justice was stronger than that of the Jews, too. That's a consistent theme through this text, too. Rome was the beast, wasn't it? The beast of Revelation. And yet here in these days, and at this juncture, at least they are still aspiring for true justice. Secondly, note with me, it was at his initiative that the Sanhedrin was assembled, too. Normally, a meeting of the Sanhedrin was called by the high priest, but not this one. This Roman tribune commanded the chief priest and all the council to meet. And thirdly, it was on his turf that they met, too. It was on his turf that they met. Luke tells us that Paul was brought down, that is, set before both the tribune and the Sanhedrin, most likely at the gates of Jerusalem, traditionally the place of public judgment. If this was a conclave of the Sanhedrin, they would have met in the temple precincts and gone up, not gone down. So, even the proceedings accord with the structure of Roman justice, too, and Roman inquiry. The Roman trial was structured such that the judge, we see this reflected in the trial of Jesus with Pontius Pilate, too, that the judge, in this case the tribune, Claudius, sat upon a seat of judgment between the two parties of a case. On his right stood the plaintiffs and their witnesses, that is, the accusers, the Jews, and then on his left stands the defendant and his witnesses, and that would be the Apostle Paul. As Ramsey observes, this is nothing like the trial of Jesus before the Sanhedrin. It is Roman, not Jewish. It proceeds more along the lines of the trial before Pontius Pilate. We know this, several other things too. Number one, the defendant makes an opening statement where Paul indeed says, I've lived a life of conscience up until this day, right? In an effort to protect the innocence of the accused, Roman law allowed the accused to speak directly after the reading of the charges. This Paul does in his opening statement. In fact, our tradition of opening statements comes from Roman law itself. Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. Secondly, note with me, the high priest is lost in the shuffle. While the high priest Ananias, once again, the historian Josephus. If you haven't read Josephus, you don't know your New Testament background. Josephus confirms that it was he who was high priest at this time. Ananias commands Paul to be smacked for this remark, and it's understandably lost on Paul, who cannot discern high priest from low priest in the shuffle of persons on the floor over on the other side of the tribune. Thirdly, then, notice as well the subsequent precipitation of believers indicates a switching of sides, too. The verbs that Luke employs to describe the dissension that erupts following Paul's defense of the resurrection, the Pharisees stood up, right, and the assembly was divided, describes a motion and a switching of sides, literally, if you will, of the Pharisees to the left of the tribune to now stand in witness for Paul. Part of Paul's strategy. And Luke demonstrates his skill as a narrator by supplying we, his Gentile audience, with what would have been arcane and recondite information about doctrinal squabbles between Sadducee and Pharisee. That is, the conservative Sadducees, they were the conservatives here, to our perplexity, the conservative Sadducees who recognized only the first five books of Moses found no evidence in the text for a bodily resurrection, nor for angels, demons, or even a distinct spiritual essence separate from the physical. They were indeed virtual first century materialists in practice. The Pharisees, who embraced subsequent revelation in the rest of the canon, acknowledged all of these, as Luke observes. So, while the tribune might have been oblivious to these differences, Paul sees it as a wedge issue that he can exploit, which he does. And as you read the commentaries here, you find the commentators just saying, oh boy, Paul is showing his real nature here. Oh, bad boy. No, you shouldn't have behaved like this. No. It's as if a president gathered before a silent assembly at a State of the Union message were to exclaim, I'm a free market capitalist, a son of Reaganomics, and it's with respect to free markets, small government, and low taxes that my policies meet opposition today. What would happen at such a State of the Union? Huh? It'd be like throwing a cup of vinegar in a pail of raw milk. This is an observation by experience, because this is how my wife makes cheese. What happens when you do that? You get a separation, don't you? Between curds and whey. Well, this is what Paul has done virtually, if you will. The assembly would erupt into two sides, right? Racist, smacks. Someone smacked that dude, right? If the president ever said anything like that. You find the others, true American. We find no fault in this man, in this policy. But this is essentially what happens when Paul begins his defense. Just one close step too, by the way. It is one close step from the doctrine of the resurrection to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Well, isn't it? But Paul doesn't get that far. Why? Why does Paul not get that far? They can't help themselves, can they? These Jews on the Sanhedrin. I call it pig ears. Pig ears. Bear with me. In training Shasta, one of our golden retrievers, we use those dried pig ears that you find in the bins, the bulk section of your grocery store, those pig ears as reward for good behavior. When we were training her, she couldn't resist pig ears. We'd set a pig ear on a chair while we taught her to sit and heel and come, and she couldn't resist. Every time we set those things out, she broke for them and scarfed it down, right? You could just see her dog mind working. She'd be listening to us say, sit, come, heel. And she'd be looking at that pig ear, and at one point she'd break. You could see her calculating. All right, I know I'll get smacked. I know I'll get chastised, but it's worth it, right? So it is with these Jews. If you wanted a reaction from them, put this man, apostle, the apostle Paul, out in front of them, right? Like pig ears to Shasta. This tribune's learning that, isn't he? Quickly. And when the dissension became violent, the text says, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. Save his own life, right? They say the Bible has no sense of humor. But this ultimately is not about Paul, is it? It's about part two of what Paul would have preached if he had not shown the cross to these vampires, right? It's about the life, death, burial, and resurrection of that divine rabbi who had so recently walked among them. It's about Jesus Christ, not about Paul. And that is what it is for us, too. Expect this from the world. You will see it increasingly in the world, in your lives. Your children sitting with you today, you parents have an obligation to prepare them for these days that are coming. You have an obligation to toughen their hearts, their minds, and their spirits, because they are going to face this overwhelmingly, if not prepared. But as if to confirm all that he had begun to preach to, the resurrected Lord appears to the apostle. This is the sweetest part of this text today, isn't it? The resurrected Lord appears to the apostle, coming to him from that unseen realm of the Spirit. Luke, skillful narrator that he is, blends this in, doesn't he? After the Sadducees implicitly deny all these things. Christ comes from the world of the unseen spirit to comfort his son, Paul. The following night, the text says, the Lord stood by him. That's an encouraging word right there. Stood by him and said, take courage. For as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome. He's being propelled closer and closer to Rome. Each phrase is crucial and sweet, I submit to you. Refreshing to a soul like Paul's at this time. The Lord will stand by you. The Lord will stand by you. You see this reflected in the lives of the saints, do you not? Luther at Wartburg, throwing chairs around, commanding the devil to go back to hell. Huss and Wycliffe also had a sense of God's presence with them when they were burned at the stake. You know, you ought to talk to this man here. Talk to Ron. Talk about the presence of God with him. You know, Ron's been arrested numerous times in the course of his life behind the Iron Curtain. He's had some scary encounters with the Stasi, with the police state. That we are seeing increasingly in our own nation. He's had encounters with the police state back in the 70s and 80s when he was photographing railroad trains. Ask him about the empty chair. Ron had, in some of those police stations, there would be an empty chair that was there. And just ask him about that empty chair and who he had a sense of being present with him during those times. Pretty scary when you're not sure you're going to get out from behind the Iron Curtain. The Lord will stand by you. So then, therefore, take courage. He says, take courage. And Paul was courageous, wasn't he? Throughout his ministry. Take courage, and you should take courage. Days are coming. Kids, young people that I see with such sweet and innocent faces, days are coming when you will need biblical courage like this. I dare say, you don't have to be a prophet or a son of a prophet to see those days coming. You will testify to the facts, the death, burial, and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ. You will testify not only where you are now, but the Lord may propel you as well. As he propelled Paul to Rome, you have a destiny toward which you are being propelled as well. Every one of you sitting here. And it may involve this kind of confrontation and conflict. It may involve facing machinations. And the Lord will use the very machinations of your enemies to accomplish his will. Always keep that in mind. And that brings us to point two. Chapter 23, verses 12 to 22. Machinations. The designs of Paul's conspirators, the assassins, will drive him in God's providence to the protection of Rome. Irony here. Great irony here. The machinery, the machinations of God's will as well falling into place now in the machinations of Paul's enemies. You can't outuse God. You may think you're defeating God, that you're sticking your thumb in the eye of God by doing evil. He sits in the heavens and laughs in scorn at you, because he will use your very machinations, your very evil deeds to accomplish his will, bring him glory and us. He will use these fanatical, vituperative rages to propel Paul towards God's venue for him, that is Rome, to stand before the emperor. But for now, and sometimes this is the worst part about suffering and persecution, is the waiting too, right? For now, Paul must sit amongst his protectors in the barracks of the fortress Antonia. Which brings to mind, how do you think so many of the Roman legionaries became Christians? You know that in not a very short period from now, the legionaries were renowned for being Christians, for being believers, converted. How do you think that started? Just imagine Paul discussing the gospel as they sat around playing Settlers of Catan with the centurions, right? While outside, God moves his plan along by providentially guiding his enemies to conspire and assassinate Paul. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. Once again, it's deja vu all over again. Note the fanaticism to which devilish zeal drives men. Devilish zeal drives men. We see this in our headlines all the time, do we not? These are true assassins. They had a name, the Sicarii. Our own word assassin, you know from whence that derives? Reading again about the Crusades. Assassin, it comes from the Muslim fanatics of the Crusades. Their name was Hashashim. Hashashim. And it's been anglicized as assassin. You hear the word hashish in there? They get stoked up on dope and then go out and kill, even if it meant their lives being sacrificed. Devilish zeal. How foolish, too. They probably failed in part because they wore out due to hunger and thirst, right? Like Saul's rash vow. Remember Saul's rash vow? He said, no man is going to eat until we have slain the Philistines. You get pretty hungry slaying Philistines. They would have been able to do a more thorough job had they eaten. Evil men make conspiracies like this. And it's always a conspiracy theory, too, to everyone but the guy about to get killed. We see how deadly a theory can be here, right? When it comes to conspiracies, I have a few great quotes, favorite quotes. The poet Thomas Pynchon, you got to think about this one. Good poets always make you think, don't they? Thomas Pynchon said, behind the hieroglyphic streets, there would either be a transcendent meaning or only the earth. Write that down and think about that. Discuss it over dinner. Behind the hieroglyphic streets, there would be either a transcendent meaning or only the earth. Sounds conspiratorial, doesn't it? Or one funny one, this takes a minute to go off in your head, too. He says, Faith Brashear says, we're always in a constant state of conspiracies. At least that's what they keep telling us. Well, these Alababi and his 40 thieves bring their conspiracy to the Sanhedrin for approval and support, don't they? And they get it. Under the pretext of receiving more testimony from Paul, these 40 will jump the small contingent sent with Paul and kill him on his way to see the chief priests and elders the next day, come what may. But alas, they cannot keep a secret, can they? They cannot keep a secret. That can only be done between two people, one of whom is dead. Keeping a secret. This famous passage from Chuck Colson. He's talking about the resurrection, but he also tells us what it's like to keep a secret and a conspiracy. He says, I know the resurrection is a fact, and Watergate proved it to me. Chuck Colson, counsel to Richard Nixon, went to jail for his part in the conspiracy to cover up the burglary at Watergate. He says, I know the resurrection is a fact, and Watergate proved it to me. How? Because 12 men testified they had seen Jesus raised from the dead. Then they proclaimed that truth for 40 years, never once denying it. Everyone was beaten, tortured, stoned, and put in prison. They would not have endured that if it weren't true. Watergate embroiled 12 of the most powerful men in the world, and they couldn't keep alive for 3 weeks. You're telling me 12 apostles could keep alive for 40 years? Absolutely impossible. So the secret is out, providentially. And we are given what one commentator calls a tantalizing insight into the apostles' family, too. That is his sister's son. So Paul had a sister and he had a nephew, didn't he? Overhears the plot and eventually gets word to the tribune, who wisely listens to him and changes plans, doesn't he? Do you see how God's providence works? You know, we're not given a meanwhile back at the ranch at every juncture here, but we see, indeed, God promises Paul, take courage, you're going to testify to me yet, even in Rome, even as you have done here in Jerusalem. Now, all of that's unfolding. The evil machinations of his enemies are being used, employed to propel him there. Brings me to point three then, chapter 23, verses 23 to 35. Machinations. The machine, the designs of Paul's protectors, the Romans, will bring Paul in God's providence to Governor Felix. What I want you also to observe, it's important to observe, is Luke's narrative style, too. The closer we get to Rome, the more deliberate and explicit Luke becomes in preparing Paul's defense and ours. Once again, an author is known not only for what he leaves in and includes, but also what he leaves out. He could have included other things, excluded much of what we have here. But he has a purpose, that is building Paul's defense before the emperor. Paul is not random here. Notice several things with me. For instance, number one, Claudius Lysias is a wise, competent officer, is he not? Tribune Claudius Lysias, we finally have his name, is a wise, competent officer. Nero could be proud of it. And it's ironic, is it not, that Rome is the beast of Revelation? What a positive good here. Can you see why Paul would pen Romans 13 too, right? To obey those in authority over you. Because at this stage, Rome is still an engine of true biblical justice and order in many parts of the empire. Luke notes the conspiracy. Claudius notes the conspiracy, makes preparations to better secure his prisoner, and sets him on his journey towards Rome. He does this in part by making plans to hand him up the chain of authority, isn't he? We're seeing him now, Claudius Lysias, is handing Paul up the chain of authority that will eventually get to Rome. The first link in that chain is Felix the governor. Oh, what a fun figure he is. I'll tell you a little bit more about him next week, but for now, let me whet your appetite. Tacitus, probably the most intellectual, philosophical of all the emperors, a historian of Rome as well, says about Felix, he governed with all the authority of a king and the baseness and insolence of a slave. Tacitus. Note with me as well, the facts of this case are laid out once more. We know the facts, right? They've been gone over again and again. We've seen them reinforced. But they're laid out once more in this letter. If repetition is the soul of learning, it's also the handmaid of persuasion, too, isn't it? The old saying of the lawyer, if the facts are on your side, pound the facts. If the law is on your side, pound the law. If neither are on your side, pound the table. Well, Luke doesn't have to pound the table here because both the facts and Roman law are on his side, not to mention the sovereign God of the universe. So this letter that Luke includes in his narrative, very deliberately, should be persuasive indeed that Paul has done nothing deserving death or imprisonment. Okay, Nero, he hasn't done, all of your officials are bearing this out. So Nero, you should too. Thirdly, Paul is escorted with the full protection of Rome in the interest of justice. Some 270 Roman legionnaires set out to escort Paul down the road towards the sea in Herod's Praetorium in Caesarea. Does it via the fortress of Antipatris, which was midway between the two. This really has all the expense and care of the Secret Service and safety of the president. Oh, maybe not the expense. Billions of dollars for Secret Service protection. Luke is careful to show how interested Rome in this part of the empire, at least, how interested Rome is still being careful to protect the rights of a citizen and uphold the old Roman ideal of justice. The old Roman ideal of justice. The chapter closes with us in anticipation, right, of the trial before Felix. What kind of a man is this guy, Felix? What kind of a trial will he unfold? And slowly but ineluctably, Paul is making his way to present the gospel before kings and governors, right? Our Lord promised, prophesied, that you will bring the gospel. You will tell of me before kings and governors. And this in spite of every conspiracy thrown his way. So, whatever your thoughts are on conspiracy theories, there is one certain conspiracy, isn't there? Satan is the adversary of God. Evil conspires against good. And the serpent still whispers the anti-gospel into the ears of the children of Adam and Eve. There is still this conspiracy, is there not? A true and genuine conspiracy at work. And it continues to unfold. But you, and kids, especially parents, you are obligated. You are burdened to communicate this to your children. That the Lord stands by you. They are going to face dark days, darker days than we will, right? You need to prepare them for those dark days. You can't see them coming. Open your eyes! The Lord will stand by you. And then from that knowledge, knowing that God will stand by you, talk to Ron, that frail frame betrays a tough soul, I dare say. From that knowledge, you may take courage, too, in order to, that you might, in your own way, in your own place and time, in your own corner of the vineyard, testify to the facts of the gospel in your Jerusalem, and ultimately to your Rome. You will be propelled somewhere, all of you. How many kids are in here? You will all have your Jerusalems and your Rome. You must be ready and willing to stand. Well, let us now come to that place where we find courage in real grace given us in the body and blood of the Savior, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.